And before I launch into this bit, I just want to tell you I'm uncomfortable talking about sex on stage because I have this theory that female comedians of my generation, when we were coming up in comedy in the early aughts, we were encouraged to talk about our sex lives on stage because it was like the only way we could get men in the audience to listen. So as I got older, I was like, that. I'm not going to talk about sex on stage. I'm going to talk about politics instead. And long story short, that's why nobody knows me.
That's a clip from comedian Jenna Friedman's Peacock comedy special, Lady Killer. The special delivers definitive proof that Jenna is one of the bravest and most provocative comedians working these days. And she is not trying to make you feel comfortable. She's actually trying to make you feel uncomfortable. Why? Because she wants to talk about what's on her mind. And if it just so happens to be on the dark side, that's understandable because these are dark times, in her opinion. Just a quick warning. Jenna and I tackle controversial issues like abortion and violence in America. She joined us from her LA home to talk about Lady Killer, which she describes as an hour of dark feminist stand-up comedy.
Yeah, it is pretty dark. I think it also, just being pregnant, people have a very different reaction to you when you're on stage pregnant. And and my comedy's always been pretty morbid, but to be pregnant while you're doing it, that disconnect, I think, is a lot for people, but it was so much fun to actually perform.
Yeah, and so much fun to watch. You sold your special before you became pregnant.
Yes.
And before Roe versus Wade was overturned. How did those two events change the way you wrote jokes?
Well, typically, comedians, before we tape specials, we will be working out jokes for at least 6 months or longer. Sometimes people will be touring a show for a couple years before they tape, do like 100 or more shows before they tape. Because I was pregnant during a pandemic, I wasn't really performing indoors at the clubs, and I was writing jokes on the fly a lot more than I would have liked to.
I should have opened with Roe. Which is a great baby name for the one you're going to be forced to have. Pretty soon, all the kids, and there will be so many of them, won't even know what the word abortion means. You'll have your son tugging on your maternity boyfriend jeans, being like, "Mommy, Mommy, what's up abortion?" And you'll have to be like, "Well, little Wade."
There are definitely timely jokes in there. Are they all as polished as I would have liked them to be? Maybe not. But that was just a function of trying to write material as the news was changing and as I was physically changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very challenging. That makes your achievement of turning out, creating such a great special, all the more impressive. Abortion isn't a laughing matter for a lot of people, but you've addressed it a lot before with your work on The Daily Show and your 2016 special. Why is this subject important to you?
Abortion isn't a laughing matter, but what's going on now is so scary and horrifying. And I think, well, okay, everything I do think is a laughing matter, to be honest. I think you can make jokes about everything.
I know abortion is a sensitive topic, and if anything I say makes you uncomfortable, feel free to leave. I would never dare force you to do anything against your will.
I understand that, you know, people have sensitivities across the board, but the fact that we're not talking about it, we're letting people who really have no grasp of science or medicine or women's health dominate the conversation. And because they're dominating it, they're able to pass policies that are actually killing people. The fact that if you have an ectopic pregnancy, which is will never be viable and you can't get it removed in certain states, is atrocious. There are so many things going on right now that I think because everyone is so afraid to talk about them, we've let people who don't have the best intentions dictate policy, and we're in a really, really dangerous position. So I think not only is it a moot point whether or not abortion's funny, I think we have to just talk about it and take back the narrative, because people's lives, women's lives are on the line.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right about that. You come across as very fearless on stage, and you're not afraid if the joke doesn't land. And in fact, it seems to me at times that you kind of actually like it, because you get to provide your own laugh track. Your comedy has been described as confrontational. Is that how you see it?
No, I don't know. I always joke about what I find interesting or funny or absurd or what makes me angry. I'm not doing it to shock people, but I will say that there's one specific joke in the show that is a joke about miscarriage, and miscarriage is a sensitive issue, but as I've gotten older, a lot of my friends have gone through it, and people, I think, because there's such a stigma around it, when it happens to you, you feel even more alone because you don't realize how common it is.
You guys are so scared. What you need to realize is that everybody miscarries. That is a children's book that hasn't been written yet. Everybody miscarries. We just don't talk about it because you guys react like this. But while we're not talking about it, they are legislating it. They're criminalizing it. In Indiana, there is a law where they want women who miscarry to have to bury the goop. Yes, yes. And there's no word for the byproducts of conception, so let's just call it Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand.
And I did that joke before I was pregnant, and it definitely got groans, but people laughed. But then doing that joke being visibly pregnant, the audience was so much more uncomfortable. And I think because I knew the joke worked when I wasn't pregnant, it gave me the confidence to tease and bait the audience, because I knew that reaction was really just because they were looking at me and judging me for being pregnant, as opposed to actually taking in the joke and enjoying the joke.
So if your comedy isn't confrontational, how would you describe it?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it could be confrontational. I guess I'm not trying to make people feel comfortable. I think there's so much other time. Watch the Great British Bake Off for that, you know? Like, I'm not...
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't think about how other people... I guess one of the downsides to, you know, what I do, or maybe why I'm not like a household name by any stretch of the imagination, is because I'm not like thinking like what's going to make the audience feel good, which I think a lot of comedians do and a lot of people do in entertainment. And I think I kind of come more from a place of like, what do I want to say? And it's taken a lot longer for that to resonate with people, but when it does, it's even more rewarding.
We have to laugh, otherwise we would just cry. There's a lot to cry about, but... And I just want you all to know, for the record, I love men. I love men. One of my best friends is a man. I love men. I'm half man on my dad's side. Just got it checked.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if people thought of it as confrontational, that's cool.
You're not a household name yet, but I think that
nobody has homes anymore.
Wait.
People, there's a housing crisis. So who needs to be a household name anymore?
Right, exactly. You're right. But it's important what you're doing, that it appeals to you. And it's as you said, it's not the kind of material content a lot of other comedians do, and maybe audiences don't care for, because it's too kind of, you know, heady and thought-provoking. But I think that's all the more important that and all the more valuable that you are doing that.
I'll take it. Yeah. I mean, I did a show in Wisconsin. I think someone at the Stoughton Opera House, it was a really fun show. And I think a lot of people came, I think, because they listened to your show. And it was cool. It's more fun, provided that everyone's civil. It's more fun for me to perform for people who don't know my comedy or know what I'm doing. It's always tickled me a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. One of the other subjects that you talk about, well, you talk about several subjects, but another one is about how America hates moms. Why does America hate moms?
I think, as I said in the special, you can just look at our policies that we have in place. we don't live in a country where it's easy for people who have children, particularly mothers, to thrive.
You can tell by our laws. We are the only developed nation without paid leave. The best way to get the government to pay for your time off as a new mom is to become a cop and shoot someone.
We make it so hard for women in the workforce. Working mom, I said this in my first special, it's like chai tea, two words that mean the same thing, as if being a mom isn't work. We have this idea of like American independence, and this idea that you can make it on your own without help. And anybody who's a mother, particularly a new mother, needs help. And we don't allow for that.
Very well said. You've said about your true crime series, Indefensible, that you try to make light out of the darkness. How challenging was it for you to make light out of the darkness for Lady Killer?
I mean, the stand-up special, I think we pulled off the best version of what that show could have been given the parameters we were dealing with. You know, it is dark. From I co-directed it with Shannon Hartman, and that was the intent was to have it visually kind of look dark, and you're focused on the performer on stage, and even down to what I was wearing, I wanted to blend in with the curtain behind me so that the pregnancy kind of fades into the background and you just see this person on stage talking. You don't see my pregnant body. We are also in really dark times, so I don't think the special is particularly darker than what people are experiencing, or just, you know, people in our country with everything going on having nothing to do with women's health, everything else. I think the pandemic, the economy, people are kind of in a dark place, a lot of people.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is indeed the case. Now that Trevor Noah is leaving The Daily Show, there's speculation about who should replace him. I'm thinking it should be you, Jenna Friedman. Are you interested?
Of course I'm interested. It's never going to happen. And I appreciate you saying that. I've gotten some texts from friends and I've seen some blogs pitching me, and I would do it in a heartbeat, but it's never, there's just no way. I'm not up.
Why? Why is there no way?
Well, I think in my most cynical, the most cynical side of me, just how these decisions get made, like I just don't think I'm in the running. I think that there are a lot of things beyond just people's comedic voices that put them in the running for a job like that, and I don't think it's going to happen. That said, if it did happen, I would welcome it. It would be incredibly thrilling. I would do it yesterday. I would love that job. I worked at The Daily Show.
Yeah, as a field producer.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So let's pretend that you're wrong, that you're sure. Wrong, and it is going to happen. Uh-huh. What would be your vision for The Daily Show with Jenna Friedman?
I mean, you can't top Jon Stewart. Trevor did an excellent job. He had the biggest shoes to fill, and he did a great job. I think it's never going to happen, but I will say one thing about Jon. So Jon announced his retirement from the show, and while he was doing that, I was working with Jordan Klepper on a field piece in Florida. And it was a piece about guns, how in the state of Florida, they actually have they had a gag order at the time. It's probably still in effect, where physicians couldn't legally warn parents about gun safety. It's totally bizarre, but that was what our piece was about. And we were talking to a Second Amendment attorney who was a kind of wackadoo. And the news came out that Jon was leaving the show, and we all found out at the same time. And this attorney, who had polar opposite political views from Jon, was still sad to see him go. And to me, that just sounded like such a triumph, that someone who doesn't agree with you could still appreciate you and watch you. And I think that, I don't know if it's possible for anyone else to fill those kinds of shoes, but to me, that would be the goal of like the next host of that show, just to kind of bring people back. We're so polarized right now. It'd be cool to be able to, I don't even know if it could ever be a woman, to be honest, but whoever it is, it would be cool to see, because I do think that that's something that we need desperately right now as a country.
Yeah. If you don't mind my asking, did you get any of that kind of positive feedback from people who have watched Lady Killer, people that maybe didn't agree with you, but said, you know, similar things to what that gentleman said to Jon?
I haven't gotten a ton of feedback on it. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, but there hasn't been anyone who disagrees with me politically who's like, this is a good show. Not yet, no.
Yeah, Yeah, yeah. Jenna Friedman, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Lady Killer, and congratulations in advance on The Daily Show with Jenna Friedman.
I think
it might happen, seriously.
Thank you.
Comedian Jenna Friedman joined us to talk about her Peacock stand-up comedy special, Lady Killer. Find out more about Jenna and her special at wpr.org/beta.
There really isn't another band that quite straddled as many of the subgenres as Cheap Trick did. And also, they were funny and kind of satirical, self-deprecating.
Coming up, author Brian J. Cramp joins us to talk about how Cheap Trick is still rocking and rolling almost 50 years after they began. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.